Call the Tax Committee to order. Is Representative Woodard here? If we could get Representative Woodard, we would be able to work on that one. A lot of members, including Representative Davids and I, are in Ways and Means simultaneously. So we've been asked to make sure that if there's any votes or any roll calls, that we get people where they need to be. So I thought one way to deal with that is to start with Representative Woodard's bill. But I don't know where he is, so let me see what else. I don't have an agenda. Representative Dill is here. Let's go with him. He's giving me this look like, hey, I'm standing here. Representative Dill. Oh, perfect. Representative Dill now moves House File 2852 to be before the committee. This is the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill. And Representative Dill, we just want to hear about any things that taxes might care about here. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The item that you would care about, would it be respective to fees?
It's all yours.
And if you look through the bill and you see places like page 9 where we're changing fees, we're actually lowering fees. In 2012, Representative Hackbarth had a bill that established certain fees for certain licenses that were lower than the existing fees that were assessed for licenses, hunting license, fishing licenses. And this bill goes back and makes a technical correction, or at least these provisions in the bill make a technical correction, lowering the lifetime fees to reflect the yearly fees, because that wasn't accomplished. And really, that from that standpoint, those are the items in the bill. We also had an amendment, the A18 amendment, that needs to be adopted, if I can, to move the bill on and get it in its further condition. So that's the fee issue. We're actually saving people money by doing this bill, by lowering the lifetime fees that are associated in conjunction with one-year fees or multiple-year fees in the case of the bill. The A18 amendment, if you want to move that, I would then, or do you want me to explain the A18?
I have to move your bill now formally because I moved it before we had a quorum, so okay. I'm going to make the motion again. So just to be clear on that, the motion is actually to move that House File 2852 be re-referred as amended, we haven't amended it yet, to Ways and Means. Is that your understanding? Okay. And now I'll move the A18. Is that correct? Okay, the A18.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, the amendment before you, there's a portion in the bill that has to do with disability licenses for 100% disabled hunters. They right now have to take a package of papers that looks like this that they get from their doctor and go up to a license branch and say, I'm 100% disabled. I get the following licenses for free. And so then you have someone that doesn't really know a whole lot about all of this paperwork issuing a license. What this bill does is it puts on the back of the license the emblem and in the micker that you are 100% disabled, and when they slide it through the licensing system, it comes up the menu of things that they can get for free. So it makes it easier for the 100% disabled, and it makes it easier for the license issuer because they don't have to try and figure out state statute while they're standing there issuing a license. This has to do, but we in the amendment, we're eliminating three things, I believe. The muzzleloader provision, because that is not a permanent. The scopes on muzzleloader provision, which is not a permanent disability, you have to keep retesting for that. And you're removing the hunting from a motor vehicle. That is not a permanent thing as well. You have to continue to have ongoing proof of that, and you have the endorsements for crossbow on the driver's level. By removing those three things, we now make it so that it's very much more simpler for the DNR to mesh their system into having it read on the computer and reducing the fiscal notes substantially from what they posted originally, which I think was around 109,000. Now, I don't know what that note is because the bill hasn't been evaluated with this amendment on it, but it will be substantially lower, and it does come from the Game and Fish Fund. So I don't see this as controversial in making it cheaper for the DNR and making so it's actually functional with their system. And Representative Earhart has heard this bill as well in transportation, all about this issue of driver's licenses, and all those people are happy. Okay, hope so that explained it. Long explanation for something that we're trying to make easier.
Okay, so we need to vote to put your A18 on. Generally, that's what we do for authors. So all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The A18 has been adopted. And so, members, we're really here to focus on any revenue issues, not kind of the bigger policy issues mm-hmm. that Game and Fish is about. Are there any questions for Representative Dill? Or I see Mr. Myers here as well. Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, I'm just, there was a piece that we thought we had forgot that actually was on another bill. We had talked about putting it on this bill because we thought it was lost on this bill, but I think we got it on another bill. So I'm just verifying that.
And Madam Chair, that is correct. Representative Hansen is taken care of in another bill.
Okay, well, that seems to be between the three of you. I'm not sure what that was. But it doesn't appear to be a tax item. Is that right, Representative Hansen?
That's correct.
Okay. Further questions for Representative Dill or anyone else? Anyone from the public would like to speak for or against this bill? If not, I'm going to read it again because these motions are important. I am going to renew my motion that House File 2852, as amended, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
And recommended to pass.
Oh, now you want to pass. Yeah. Sometimes he wants us to have that word in there, and sometimes he doesn't. The new rules say we don't use that word anymore. Anyway, okay. If that's it, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The bill has passed or has been referred to 2852 or to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Dill. Is Representative Woodard here? Yes, there he is. Representative Davids moves House File 2434 to be before the committee. And members, we should have a little conversation about this. Do we, first of all, Representative Woodard, we don't have an amendment for you, right?
No.
No. Okay.
No, ma'am.
I'm going to ask staff. I don't see any sort of direction here, but do we think, is the pattern in these kind of bills, and these are rare to come to taxes, but they have in the past, would this just go right to the general register, Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, there will be no state fiscal impact of this, so it can go directly to the general register.
Okay, and as long as members feel, after we hear it, that it's not going to be a bill that people will play tax amendments on, which I don't think it is, Representative Woodard, I think we can just vote it right to the calendar. So, Representative Davids, is that okay? Your motion is to move House File 2434 to the general register?
Correct.
Okay. Okay, so that's the motion. Representative Woodard, to your bill.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. And it is a very simple bill. It allows the Silver Maple Bay Estates and Helena Township, which is in my district, to move from their current sewer system to the new Prague sewer system. The reason why this needs to come before the legislature is it also involves the removal of a subordinate service district and then allowing the township to sell those assets and use that to pay for the new connections. And interestingly enough, those of you who like revenue, the Minnesota Revenue Document says that, I haven't seen this before, but the elimination of the subordinate service district may reduce property taxes in Helena Township, and those lower property taxes will reduce state-paid property tax refunds and income tax deductions, therefore increasing state income tax revenue.
Okay. Anything else? Anybody like to speak for or against this bill? I think one thing, if it's okay with members, before we vote, because I think we appear to be fine with this. If Mr. Michael can just tell us the history of where this all started, that these even came to taxes, because my understanding is they're very rare. I think the Senate is looking to put it in their tax bill, which probably, I don't know if that's where you'd like to end up, but we think it should just continue on. But I had asked Mr. Michael about this, and I should say this bill was a late entrant, and that's why we couldn't consider it for the omnibus tax bill anyhow. But Mr. Michael, can you tell members what you told me when I asked you about these kinds of bills? So thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the authority for towns and counties to enter into subordinate service district arrangements, which is what's involved here, was something that was passed a while back, and when it was passed, it was passed both by the then local government or metro and local affairs or whatever the name was at the time and by the tax committee. The idea was, and the purpose of those arrangements is to allow a higher level of services to be provided in part of a town or a county so that you're not taxing the entire town for these for this higher level of services. And it's sort of a analog to the city provision where you can create special service districts within cities. And because of that history of the tax committee addressing that law generally, most of the special laws that have allowed individual formation of these subordinate service districts or changes to them have traditionally come to the tax committee. And so that's sort of the history of it.
Thank you for that. Thank you very much. Okay, questions for Representative Woodard? If not, Representative Davids renews his motion that this bill be sent to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The bill is passed and you're off to the General Register.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Woodard. And so now we've got Representative Nelson, who has been sitting right there behind that chair. You know, Representative Nelson, sorry about that. And members, I'm going to move House Bill 1765 before the committee, and I guess I need to remember this a little bit. Didn't we hear this last year and laid it on the table, or was it part of a consideration as part of a larger bill? And then I think it was also brought up in the conference committee, and it was the House's position. But I'm trying to remember where the bill started last year, and maybe Representative Nelson, Ms. Lunenberg can help you if you can't recall. Representative Nelson.
I believe you're correct in that. I think it was laid over to be possibly included, and that's where it was. Like I said, the Senate, I think, had it in their tax bill, and then it wasn't part of the conference committee report that came forward. So I think that's where it is. I think we had discussion on the floor about this, too.
Okay, so the motion for this is to lift this bill from the table and be referred to the General Register. Is there an amendment on this bill?
There's an amendment. I believe it should be in your packet. It's A14-1044. And what this does is basically it puts the bill in the form, the language of the Senate, current Senate bill.
Oh, well, that's not... I mean, doesn't mean anything to us.
I know, but it's reining it in a little bit.
Okay, so I will move for the author the A2 amendment. The A2 was that
it's
or the
A14-1044.
The 1044. This is the author's amendment. Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. The 1044 is adopted to get the bill in the form the author would like it. Representative Nelson.
And. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I will let Mr. Lunenberg describe the bill. Basically, what we're doing here, I mean, there's a lot of controversy around labor peace. There's going to be a lot of people there, or a few people here, that are going to be talking about this bill. But basically what this bill does is it's about protecting the proprietary financial interests of the state when we invest in infrastructure projects, and that's what this is about. The unions... Going forward, it restricts what they can do. I mean, currently, if there's a project and they can do all sorts of actions, concerted actions against the project to slow it down and prevent it from taking place. And what this does is, when the state has an interest in the project, we're requiring that the developer sign a labor peace agreement, which prevents those things from happening. The developer then says, "We will let you talk to the workers." And that's basically all it lets them do, is lets them talk to the workers and sell their idea of being joining a union. But it doesn't create a union, doesn't force a union, it doesn't do any of that. But it protects our rights so the project goes forward and gets built, and we as a state have a proprietary interest in that, making sure it gets done on time so it doesn't end up costing more money and costing the state more money. And that's basically what the bill does. And that's what the labor peace agreements do. And there are... common across the country in the hospitality industry. Most of the major hotels chains do these at a normal base or a normal course of business. The Republican National Party, when they came here for their national convention 2 years ago, that was, they signed a labor peace agreement so that there was not disruptions of the Republican National Party convention. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Lunenberg, and he can describe the bill or describe more thoroughly.
Mr. Lunenberg, welcome to the committee.
And thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I'll try to keep my readers on straight today. I sat on them earlier today. So, my name is Wade Lunenberg, and I'm the Secretary Treasurer of Unite Here and the Minnesota State Council of Unite Here Unions. We represent approximately 6,000 workers in Minnesota, primarily in hotels, all the major sports venues, convention centers, cafeterias, and we also have 1,100 people on the field at MSP Airport. As Representative Nelson mentioned, labor unions do certainly have a right to cause economic disruptions as a way to answer uncooperative management, but it's not our preferred way of doing business. We prefer to simply have an agreement up front with management that clearly defines what each party can and cannot do in a potential campaign to organize. In these agreements, the union gives up their rights to boycotts and economic boycotts and to pickets. In return, the employer agrees to remain neutral in the process of individual workers choosing to join a union or not. The benefit to the state, the developer, and to the union in these agreements is that an orderly process has been created. The state has a certainty of knowing that there won't be pickets or economic boycotts that can affect the opening or operations of a public project. To the union, we negotiate appropriate access to the workers and the ability to ask whether or not they'd like to join the union without fear or harassment from management. And for the operator, a guaranteed smooth running operation when and if an organizing campaign were to occur. It should be noted that union organizing efforts aren't always successful. In the Volkswagen plant in Tennessee recently, the company took a neutral position and to the union's organizing efforts. After the UAW spoke to workers, they had an election and ultimately chose not to join the UAW. Likewise, nothing in this legislation forces workers to join a union. It simply creates a neutral process for workers to make an informed decision without conflict. Even though public dollars, in some cases many millions of dollars, are spent on hospitality projects in Minnesota, there's no automatic right for the public or for unions to speak with workers. This process creates that platform for all parties to operate in an agreed upon way. My union, Unite Here, works hard to advocate for working people to ensure that their work is respected, their wages are fair, and that they have good health and pension benefits. Some would suggest that along the way, we, along with employers, help create and maintain a very important standard in our industry. We are in the business of moving workers forward in this vast industry. We're also in the business of moving working people's families forward in the larger community. We believe that having a good policy like this helps do just that. With that, I'm stand for questions, and I'm asking for your support today on Representative Nelson's bill.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Would anybody like to testify for or against this bill? Okay, Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Nelson, you had mentioned that there's, and I think both of you mentioned that there's nothing that causes anyone to join a union, but I think that's confusing because in subdivision 2, starting on line 2.6, it says any employee of hospitality workers on a qualified project must have a negotiated and executed labor peace agreement as a condition precedent if there's a proprietary interest. So could you clarify that? I don't see how if you have to have a labor peace agreement, wouldn't you have to be in a union? Isn't that the meaning of labor?
Madam Chair, Representative Pepin, no. The labor peace agreement just says that the management side is going to allow them to talk. They're not going to do the things that happen in a lot of these cases where they aren't labor peace agreements, harassing workers, threatening firing, all these things that happen as part of sometimes happens on management side to prevent their workers from talking to the union. And the union agrees that they're going to give up their right to strike, they're going to give up the right to picket, do disruptions on the job, national boycotts, those type of things. So both sides are saying we're going to give up our rights just so we can sit down and have a conversation about this. It doesn't create a union. It just says the labor peace agreement says that management is going to not do the things that they can do on their side, and Labor saying, we're not going to do things on our side. We just want to be able to have a conversation. And that's all this bill does, the Labor Peace Agreement does, is allows that conversation to happen without a lot of the recrimination and stuff that goes on, the nasty things we hear in the press about, which are some of the things that the labor unions don't want to do either, but it's, sometimes they have to resort to those tactics to get their ability to organize, which is guaranteed in federal law.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nelson, so I'm still not very clear on this. So if I'm a worker but I'm not in a union, then who is the labor peace agreement with? That doesn't make sense to me. In other words, if I'm not represented by a union, then who is the labor peace agreement with?
The labor peace agreement, Madam Chair and Representative Pepin, the labor peace agreement will be between the union that's attempting to organize these workers and the management of the company. And but it doesn't create a union. It doesn't create a union contract. It just says that we're going to allow you to talk to our workers, and we're not going to do the things that we could do to prevent you from doing that. We're going to let you have that conversation. And as was the case in Tennessee with the Volkswagen plant, it doesn't guarantee that a union is going to be formed. It just gives the opportunity for people to talk.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Nelson. I think that's a little confusing. I do have another question on when we're looking at the definition of hospitality workers. We're talking about all-time or part-time employees, and that includes catering, cafeteria, sports facilities, etc. So a union, if they wanted to organize a caterer, then they would also be. How does that work with the labor peace agreements for a caterer that comes in one or two times?
Representative Nelson.
In a case like that, if they're, Madam Chair and Representative Pepin, in a case like that, if they're, an example was given to me of a civic center that has a number of catering people, that this is our list of preferred caterers, and you can choose from one of these to come in here, and you're hiring them, you're renting the hall, and then you're hiring them, you're the one that's doing the hiring, they're not employees of the hall or the facility. But what this would go after is if you're going to hire these people and they're going to work all the time for that facility or part-time for that facility, and that's going to be their employment, then the labor peace agreement would take place. But if they're a caterer and you're hiring them to do the catering and they're on the preferred list, they would not be party to that labor peace agreement, and they wouldn't have to have one signed either.
Madam Chair, well, what if the caterers or any part-time employer, whoever, doesn't want to unionize, so they say I reject this, I don't want to unionize, does there still have to be a labor peace agreement between nobody that's unionized and the hotel?
Mr. Nelson or Mr. Lunenberg.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll take another stab at answering your question and then see how that works. I'm aware of the question, where that question might be coming from. If you're expanding a convention center, and you currently have been using a number of preferred caterers, it appears from what I understand these caterers are coming in and basically renting the space along with the person that's having the party. They're coming into the convention center and renting the space, doing the business, and paying for the space and exiting, right? In most convention centers, particularly of any significant size, there would be a single concessionaire that runs the operation, whether you're selling hot dogs or serving dinners of 800 and 1,000 people. And those folks, and that single concessionaire, or might be two or three concessionaires, have contracts with the city or the principal owner, whether it's a county that owns a convention center or a city that owns the convention center. And so those folks would actually be in a position of having to sign labor peace agreements.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson. I'm not really sure. I guess you talked about this protecting the proprietary interest in the state. And to me, this looks like it's really kind of trying to force a whole bunch of people who wouldn't necessarily be interested in joining a union because of their limited, their catering or their part-time, and you're really forcing not only for contracts, subcontracts, leases, subleases. You're really forcing folks into it, and I don't. It's very difficult to understand why we would need labor peace agreements for folks who maybe don't even want to be unionized. When it's saying any employer has to be must have negotiated and executed a labor peace agreement with any interested labor organization as a condition precedent of the execution of a contract in which the state has a proprietary interest. And if the people don't want to be unionized, you're basically saying that you're having a labor union sign this peace agreement with people that maybe don't even want to be unionized. So it makes no sense to me. I think this is totally unnecessary.
Okay, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, can you characterize, you mentioned the DE amendment is shortening up from the very from the bill from last year. One thing I do see in the amendment that you made to the DE, you struck the requirement that be located in a city of the first class. So what I take that to mean is you want this to be statewide at this point. Is that correct?
Representative Nelson.
Actually, Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, it scales it back. The bill, as it was originally drafted and as the amendment that went on last year had it, it's any city and a county where there's a city of the first class. So all of Hennepin County, all of Olmsted County, all of Ramsey County, all of St. Louis County would be required, any city there with the bill last year, any city in those counties that got state money to build a project that included a hospitality industry building would be required to sign a labor peace agreement. What this bill, the amendment that we drafted to, or we put on today says it's only cities of the first class. So it would only be Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester now, and Duluth are the only cities of the first class. So they would only include those four entities, not the whole entire county. So it's actually pulling it back from what it was originally.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if counsel or maybe the author could direct us to where it says that. I'm not catching.
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, in the amendment, it's on page 1, line 12 and 13, where it defines qualifying project means a project that's located in a city of the first class.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Madam Chair, did we not adopt the A2 amendment?
No, we've taken the 1044 and adopted it, and we have not taken up the A2 yet.
Oh, okay. That's where I was confused. Okay. So, Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, do you plan to offer the A2?
Well, Madam Chair, that's not my amendment, but I don't. If someone has that amendment, I'd like to see it because I don't have that amendment.
Okay, we can get you a copy. My understanding is it's Representative Liebling's amendment. And we can talk about that in a minute. I just want to make sure, unless Representative Liebling just wants to go ahead, I was going to see if there's people for or against this bill.
Madam Chair, I had some more questions, Madam Chair.
Okay, please. We'll go to your questions, Representative Drazkowski, and then Representative Liebling has questions as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Lunenburg, the bill says that it can be executed with any interested labor organization. So, who directs this or makes the request? So if Representative Pepin owns a catering company and she has a contract with a civic center or wants to obtain one, and you are the union organizer of the
hospitality workers,
the Rochester hospitality workers, You would then initiate that on your own, and how would Representative Pepin, in her efforts to obtain the contract, realize whether or not she has satisfied this requirement?
Mr. Lunenburg, and as you answer that, could you also maybe, it'll help members who have not dealt with these understand, can you tell us some places where these exist?
All right.
So, and then walk through mechanically how that would work. But just so people know, these are in place in Minnesota already. But
certainly, Mr. Labor peace agreements in our industry are quite common. They're used across the country. And oftentimes because state, county, and municipal entities find themselves actually in the development business that leads to hospitality projects, whether it's a convention hotel, perhaps a gaming facility, certainly convention centers and sports arenas. So these are used widely across the country. Here in Minnesota, we've used them most recently in the Viking Stadium, Target Field, Target Center, the Excel Center, the St. Paul Saints Ballpark, and so forth. Representative Drazkowski, the process for Representative Pepin's catering company would be the onus would be on the interested union to contact the party, and in many cases it would be the city or perhaps the developer of the project. And it would be the onus of the union interested to reach out to them first, and then and if a labor peace requirement has been required, then that entity would tell Representative Pepin's company that there needs to be a labor peace agreement to operate in this new facility. And again, we're not reaching out and negotiating a collective bargaining agreement, making the assumption that the workers have joined a union. Instead, we're laying out a process of neutrality that may lead to an organizing campaign.
So, Madam Chair and Mr. Lundeberg's, thank you. So the onus, you said the onus is on you and the labor organization. Well, Representative Pepin thinks she's satisfied everything because no one's come to her and asked her for a labor peace agreement. And she's entering into a contract with Representative Davids, who's got a lot of money.
A lot of catering.
That's funny. Now that there is funny. So if she's entering into a contract, if Representative Davids at this point would have to be a government entity, I take it under this contract, or no, it wouldn't have to be a government entity, but would have to receive a government grant or TIF or other type of thing. If she's entering into that contract and going through the due diligence to develop the contract and do all the financials and other things to do it, so at any point during that process, when you as the union recognize that she is in the process of doing this, at any point before she sends her application in, or maybe after it's received, or when the bids are let, or when is it that she's crossed the finish line and you people are not going to be chasing her around anymore?
Mr. Lundeberg.
Chair and Representative, again, it would be the responsibility of the labor organization to be in contact with the city in starting the process for labor peace agreements. If the union shows no interest in pursuing a labor peace agreement at that project, there should not be a concern.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Lundeberg, I assume that this means card check could happen in the workplace. Is that correct?
It may lead to card check. Yes, that's correct.
So we can have, this is going to allow, basically the agreement would say that Representative Pepin cannot interfere with card check activities in the workplace as part of required part of the agreement. Last question, Madam Chair, if I could, would this apply to, I guess the question I've written out, would it apply to civic centers in Rochester, Mankato, and St. Cloud? And I guess the answer is in Rochester. Is that correct?
Representative Nelson.
It's the cities of the first class. Currently, Minneapolis has an ordinance, a labor peace ordinance, and St. Paul does them on a project-by-project basis. But that's only for money for projects that have city money in them. This would be for state money that's invested in. And Duluth also has a labor peace. I've been told it has a labor peace ordinance. But again, those only protect the city's interest. This protects the state interest where the state invests money in these projects. And their ordinances would not apply if there was no city money and only state money. Their ordinance would not apply to these projects. This is what we are trying to do is protect the state's proprietary interest in these projects by putting this legislation forward.
Representative Drazkowski.
Very last question, Madam
Chair. No problem.
Thank you. Would be, I don't see in the bill, maybe I'm overlooking it, but when, how are these agreements amended? How do they expire, or how are they terminated?
Representative, Chair, and Representative. The agreements can be 3 or 5 years. It is fluid, and again, part of negotiating the labor peace agreement is deciding when that clock starts ticking. Is it from the soft opening of a new hotel, or from the hard opening the first day that they say we're officially in business and the clock starts ticking for 24 months, 3 years, or 5 years after open? Again, negotiated between the operator and the union as part of the labor peace agreement.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that the members have asked some really good questions. And I think that what's being pointed up here is that there are a lot of ambiguities in the way this bill is drafted. And I had some of the very same questions, and I know we're going to hear other testifiers talk about some of that. And one of them, of course, just following on Representative Drazkowski, is I don't see anything in the bill that limits how long the employer has to wait for a union to show up before they can go ahead and they're kind of off the hook. But that said, I think the policy of labor peace agreements is a really good policy. I think that it obviously, as the testifier said, it's working very well in a lot of places. And I think, frankly, if we did this statewide, it would probably be a great thing for the state. And so my question right now to the testifier, and you all know I have an amendment to make this statewide, but my question is, you know, why are you narrowing it from what it was before to just cities of the first class, and why would this not be a good policy for the entire state?
Representative Nelson or Mr. Lunenberg.
I'll let Mr. Lunenberg.
First of all, Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, and thank you for the thoughtful question. Our union, Unite Here, which would be a union that has jurisdiction in hospitality, in the hospitality industry, and is recognized as the largest union in that jurisdiction, is not in a position where it would be organizing in Mankato or St. Cloud or Worthington in the future. Quite honestly, we're looking at the markets that we currently operate in, which also overlay where a lot of the state projects actually occur. And so for us, I can tell you that in Worthington, there would not be a risk for the state because there would not be a labor dispute at an expanded convention center in Worthington, Minnesota, because we do not have a presence there.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. And, you know, I think that the answer is kind of obviously because we're not there, so we don't need it there. But I think even if it's not being used currently, that if the policy is a good one, and I frankly, as I said before, I think the bill itself needs a lot of work. I think there are a lot of issues just in the drafting, even if, as I do, you agree with the policy underlying it, which I'm sure all members don't agree, but, you know, I certainly support the policy. But, you know, I guess that answer kind of isn't good enough for me because I don't really see the problem. If this is a good policy, then it should be there in case, you know, for Mankato and St. Cloud, if there should be a union, it wouldn't necessarily be your union. Could be some other union. It could be a spontaneous labor action, I suppose. And I just don't really see why we would limit it when in some places maybe it wouldn't have any impact. But that wouldn't mean that it wouldn't be a good policy to have just in place in case some union does show up and say we want to have a labor peace agreement. So, with that, Madam Chair, I'm not going to move my amendment just yet, but because I'll wait till the testimony is done.
Okay, thank you so much. Representative Davids, and then after that, let's start the public testimony. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just want to make sure that I get this correct. Maybe Mr. Michael, if I could. So really, since Duluth, Minneapolis, St. Paul already use these would this be just for Rochester?
Mr. Michael or Mr.
There's four, Madam Chair, there's four cities of the first class. Rochester just added 2011, I think.
Well,
so I guess to Mr. Michael, this would basically only apply to Rochester.
You know, I'll ask Mr. Michael to answer that, but I'll tell you, Representative Davids, my city is not a city of the first class, but it has had labor peace. So I don't think it would exclude, if I understand your bill, I think your bill is requiring in these, but it wouldn't exclude because Mall Phase 1 was done with labor peace.
And Madam Chair, I understand that Bloomington is not a city of the first class at this time. Any city could use these now. Would Mr. Michael basically, is this the Rochester labor agreement, or is this the Rochester unionization bill?
Well, Representative Davney, did you want to?
Madam Chair.
Yeah, I'm ready.
No, I thought maybe you wanted to throw in your comment there about the...
question perhaps for the author. With the amendment, would this, or no, actually to Representative Liebling, would this, with your proposed amendment, would the labor piece then apply to inns on trails?
I just had to say that.
Representative Davids.
No, actually, because of the wisdom of Chair Davney in Ways and Means Yesterday, that portion has been removed, thank God.
Yes, and we'll get a real answer here. Because I'm interested too, but I don't think in Minneapolis, I think there are projects in the Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth that have not had to consider them. In Duluth, maybe Representative Simonson knows about that, but there are some, but they're not always. So,
but
Mr. Michael.
Basically, Madam Chair and Mr. Michael, this is the Rochester unionization bill.
I don't think so, but Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, I don't think I want to respond to that precisely, but...
Good call.
I will
go to ends and trails.
To the extent that those other cities already have arrangements like this, it would be true that, you know, this would be the first mandatory labor peace requirement for Rochester, but I think the witness pointed out that this is triggered by $2 million or more of state assistance to it, and those ordinances may, in fact, in those other cities, in Minneapolis, for example, may not be triggered by, you know, a state appropriation of assistance to a hospitality project, whereas this would, and so this may actually have a material effect in Minneapolis and St. Paul and Duluth.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, that's what I said earlier. They said this is protecting the state's proprietary interest, but the ones that City Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth have deal with city interests.
Okay. Unless there are further questions at the moment, we're going to go to public testimony. Yes, Representative Draskowski.
If I could ask one more question, Mr.
Sure.
Lunenburg. So, Mr. Lunenburg, I heard you talk earlier about your characterization of the different sizes of cities, and there was some sort of economy of scale that you were attempting to express about whether it made sense for your organization or organizations to pursue these. So I got the impression that what this does is helps union membership grow. Is that what I gathered from what you said?
Mr. Lunenburg.
Chair and Representative, not necessarily, but it could lead to higher standards in these various cities of the first class.
Okay. So, Madam Chair and Mr. Lunenburg, in the cities where you have had these and added them where you haven't had them prior, has your membership gone up or down?
Mr. Lunenburg.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's fair to say that our membership has remained nearly the same.
Thank you, Madam
Draskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Lunenburg.
Okay, public testimony for or against this bill. Please, welcome to the committee.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I sit before you today representing Hospitality Minnesota, which is the umbrella organization of the Minnesota Restaurant Association, the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association, and the Minnesota Lodging Association. I'd like to start off by thanking the advocates and Representative Nelson. It was referenced last year in previous discussion here today about the definitions last year on this discussion that we had as it went through the process. Representative Drazkowski, I think, and Representative Davids touched on a little bit. Last year, the bill, as it was introduced and defined, dealt with counties that contain cities of the first class. And also the amount of state and local investment was $1 million. So I want to thank Representative Nelson and the advocates for at least limiting it down to not all counties, but just to cities of the first class, and also eliminating the local contribution and then raising that contribution from $1 million to $2 million. But, Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out a couple of concerns regarding this proposal. There is intense competition, if you will, for the hospitality dollar, whether it be through reinvestment REITs, real estate investment trusts. There are national and international management companies. There are brand restaurants that are looking around nationally and internationally to locate. And there are a number of factors that they weigh in, whether it's workforce, whether it's taxes, location, if they don't get a lot of snow on Fridays, 6 to 8 inches and on April 3rd, are factor into where they decide to locate. And this is just going to be another factor that they look at when they go through and weigh all of those. So I just wanted to point that out to the committee. Number two, if you'll look at the definitions when we go through, Madam Chair, on 2.24 through 2.28, we deal with subleases, subcontracts. So if a facility receives, in the city of first class, receives over $2 million, and then a Jamba Juice or Tony and Greg's Sports Bar wants to locate within that hotel or convention center, then they would probably be subject to a labor peace agreement through that language right there on the subcontract or sublease within that facility. And I just wanted to bring that to the committee's attention. Madam Chair, finally, if I go back, and I hate to bother keep having you flip pages, but if you go back to 1.15 on the front, the definition of a food and beverage operation that is integral to a hotel, I think is kind of wide open, and Representative David's or Representative Anzell's definition of integral and mine probably would all be different. So if a project that's in a city of the first class that has received over $2 million has a parcel of land and a hotel is erected, is a TGIF Fridays that is in that parcel of land then part of an integral part of that hotel or not? A parking garage that receives over $2 million on a parcel of land, if a hotel or a restaurant is located next to that, is that an integral part? So that was just one of the definitions that we wanted to call through and see if we could further define that. And also in redevelopment projects, as we put together the financing of those redevelopment projects, one of the examples that's been used is the Lumber Exchange Building in downtown Minneapolis. And we go through how that financing is all put together and how much state money goes into there and who would be affected into that. So those are just some of the questions I wanted to point out to the committee. Two last ones, Madam Chair. When we talk about the definition of $2 million as being the trigger to trigger this labor peace agreement, when we talk about funds, property, goods, guarantees, or allowances, and how we add that all up, are the bonds counted? Is it revenue bonds or GOP bonds? And how we get to that $2 million was a question that we had. And then finally, Madam Chair, and we've had some preliminary discussions with Representative Nelson and the advocates on the binding arbitration, and we appreciate their preliminary discussions with that, but that was also a concern of ours. So, Madam Chair, just to make the committee aware that there is some large investments out there nationally and internationally that will be watching this. This will be a factor in their decision. Some of the definitions I pointed out, and then the binding arbitration that we will keep talking to Representative Nelson and the advocates about, Madam Chair. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. Further testimony for or against this bill? Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jerry Williams. I'm the interim president of the Rochester Area Chamber of Commerce. We have over 1,400 members, the largest chamber of commerce in the state of Minnesota, and I'm really pleased to be here. First of all, before I begin my testimony, I want to say thank you very much for your efforts and your support a year ago for the Destination Medical Center. That is going to be a significant economic issue going forth for the state of Minnesota, and we appreciate your support of that. We'd also like to thank Representative Nelson for a discussion that was had late yesterday with city staff and others regarding this bill. I would note that we have only recently learned about the bill. The implementation of this bill, as has been pointed out, would be really focused on Rochester, would be very complicated, and what we feel as the Chamber of Commerce is not necessarily in our best interest. We do have some significant concerns. Let me point out, though, that we have had a very good relationship overall with unions in Rochester for many years. They've been strong partners with many chamber activities, with our highly successful sales tax renewal rate 17 months ago, and with the DMC initiative. Our major concern about this legislation is from a statewide public policy perspective. This legislation targets four of the 900 cities in Minnesota for special state labor peace agreement requirements, which we did not seek. In 2013, similar legislation targeted all cities in the counties in which there was a first-class city. Now this has been reduced to target a smaller subset of Minnesota cities. Good statewide policy, in our opinion, should have statewide application. Local communities can, if they so choose, adopt ordinances that go beyond the state requirements. But that is typically left to their choice in cases which there is not legislation or rules applying to all cities. Each city has its own unique economy, business climate, and local politics. If we are to have additional state requirements to be applied to Rochester, we believe that puts us in contrast to the most comparable cities to Rochester, which are other regional Minnesota centers. Rochester has been a member of Greater Minnesota Regional Initiatives for over 30 years. We have more in common with Mankato, St. Cloud, and Moorhead, for example, and some other regional centers than we do with Minneapolis and St. Paul. The bill lumps Rochester in for requirements that apply to cities 2 to 4 times our size with regard to labor peace agreements. Of the four cities being targeted for this legislation, we have been advised that two of them have previously chosen to adopt an ordinance or policy relating to labor peace agreements. That was their choice. In our case, we would also like to retain the same right to decide if that is the best course for our city and for the DMC in our future. Part of the stated rationale for this bill is to protect state investments, but it is unclear to us why the state would have a stronger interest in protecting its investments in Rochester or Duluth than it does in St. Cloud or Mankato. Regarding the DMC, if this legislation is approved, it would apply to many private development projects that could be constructed as components of the DMC initiative in Rochester. The bill's provision would apply to a broad range of businesses and is not restricted to hotels, but food and beverage facilities and cultural and sports venues also. The legislation notes that it would also apply to infrastructure constructed specifically to support a hotel, food, and beverage operation and cultural venue. The legislation is not clear in what that means, but it could be interpreted to broaden the legislation's application to almost any hotel or venue project constructed in the DMC, even if that project did not directly receive any state funding assistance. For example, if the city were to use state funding to increase the capacity of a street or the electric system in the downtown with state funding, and the project uses those facilities, that would seem to require that a hotel project with no direct state funding assistance would have to enter into a labor peace agreement. The broad scope of this language is concerning, as the city will also be doing some infrastructure projects in this area with city funds, and we can anticipate that there may be confusion whether businesses benefiting from those investments in the DMC project area by the city will also lead to requests for labor peace agreements. We in Rochester are on the cusp of some of the most significant economic development ever seen in the state, with an extraordinary number of jobs being produced. Let us deal with these things. We problem solve all the time down there, and we are very good at it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We have three members on the list. I suggest we finish public testimony and then we can come back to anyone else, because I think is there someone else after the next testifier? Because I think this is it. So if we could get your testimony, then we have a number of members waiting to ask questions. Maybe they're for the previous testifier, Representative Nelson. I don't know. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Perfect timing.
How timely is that? Sorry about that. My name is Gary Newman. I work for the City of Rochester, and as Jerry indicated, we believe we also have a good relationship with our unions in Rochester, and we certainly would want to ensure that that continues. We do have some concerns about the bill, though. We think it's a pretty complicated approach to what the intent is of allowing a conversation between the unions and their employers. I would hope that there would be kind of simpler ways to address that. Just to cover a couple of the items of concern to us, with regard to the Mayo Civic Center Convention Center addition, which we hope to secure bonding for, and for that project, I would note we plan to do a project labor agreement for the construction of that facility, which is not a requirement, but something that we're planning. Currently, all the employees at our Mayo Civic Center are union employees in five different bargaining groups. However, for more than three decades in that building, we have had a private concessionaire arrangement. And if this bill is approved, we believe we'd have to strike another arrangement and have that concessionaire enter into a project labor agreement. And as has been discussed earlier with regard to catering, for over 30 years, we've allowed a lot of caterers to work in our building, 17 of them. 17 different local businesses do catering at the Mayo Civic Center. If this legislation were to pass, it's our view that the city, the concessionaire, and all those 17 caterers would have to have a project or a labor peace agreement. Obviously, some of them might not proceed with that. And so I think that would be a strong concern to our local business community, the fact that all of those businesses would have to do that as a condition of operating at the Civic Center. At least that's our reading of the language. The legislation requires that a labor peace agreement must be entered into prior to the execution of a contract, a grant agreement, or an agreement for financial assistance. What that would mean, should the legislature approve the bonding for the Mayo Civic Center, is that we would have to wait, in our view, until a labor peace agreement is executed or multiple labor peace agreements are executed before the city could finalize and execute a bonding agreement with the state of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Cities operating under that provision would not have very much leverage in the process and would have to go with the conditions of the agreement presented to us, or we would get into binding arbitration before the project gets constructed. So that is a concern. We have also some other concerns about other sections of the bill, and I'll just point out a few of those. In the bill's language, it requires final and binding arbitration to settle all disputes on working conditions. Binding arbitration is not typical for all union agreements. For the City of Rochester, we have 19 different bargaining units, and there are only a few of those that have binding arbitration. They relate to essential service, essential employees, police, fire, certain supervisory personnel, but the majority, vast majority of our union contracts do not have binding arbitration. Under the bill, a private company could be forced to enter into a labor peace agreement with multiple unions that might be seeking to represent the workers, so that's another issue. I think one other thing to point out is that the definition of hospitality workers is very broad and includes all full-time and part-time employees of hotels, so it's virtually all the employees that are in a hotel or their food and beverage operation. If the intent of the legislation is to allow the union to talk to and work with hotel, food and beverage venue employers, which we would agree is a very good idea, we would hope there would be other simpler ways to address that. We've not attempted to list all the areas in the bill that we believe are of concern. Partially, you know, we're fairly new in looking at this bill. We weren't involved in that last year. I think the League of Cities was involved in the bill because it had broader application. Our biggest overall concern, though, is the one that Jerry mentioned, and that is that this would be adopted for only a few cities, and sounds like mostly one city, but I don't know where Duluth is at on this. And so I guess we would ask if that's a policy concern for the legislature to target at a small group of cities. So those are my comments. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. So we have Simonson, Schoen, Anzels, Anderson, Benson, Davids. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Apologize for my voice, but I have a question for the gentleman from the Rochester Chamber of Commerce.
Please.
And I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Jerry Williams.
Okay. Mr. Williams, I want to make a comment on one of the things you mentioned was that this is a Rochester bill, and this is clearly not a Rochester bill. I think that's been touched on upon by testimony and by the author of the bill and by members of the committee, that what this bill does is it affects state investments and currently in four cities of the first class. So to suggest that this is a Rochester-only bill is a little bit misleading. My city of Duluth, has had since 2006 a labor peace agreement ordinance in place to protect the interests of the city where city dollars are invested. And the passage of this bill, if it's signed into law, would apply to state dollars that are invested within the city of Duluth, as well as your city, too. So I just wanted to correct you on that. But my question is, and maybe you were here last year, maybe you weren't, I don't know. There was a lot of folks from Rochester here last year.
I was not.
But do you recall how much state money we invested in Rochester in the bill that we passed last year?
I do recall. Madam Chair, Representative, I do recall that. There was a total of approximately $585 million of public dollars going to Rochester for public purposes. Of that $585 million, $128 million comes from the city of Rochester, and the city is now examining various ways on how they're going to deal with that $128 million. And the other $40 million is from Olmsted County, which must be used for transportation purposes. The rest of the dollars come through, as I understand, the state bonding or state contribution to Rochester, the $585 minus the $128 minus the $40 million, as a small part of the significant increase in taxes, whether it's property taxes, corporate taxes, income taxes, sales taxes, that will be coming into the state of Minnesota from DMC. This is a small piece of that coming back to Rochester for public purposes, for infrastructure, to continue this economic effort.
Representative Simonson.
And you're welcome for that. My question is, with respect to the labor peace agreement, I don't understand what the problem is, and I've listened to your testimony, and I've listened to the other testimony, and I'm having a real hard time understanding, because a labor peace agreement is not negotiation of a contract. Essentially, what it does is it eliminates the potential for a labor unrest in the public. It's not negotiating a contract. It doesn't complicate your life all that much. Oh, and that's probably funny, I'm sure, but the reality is that the little bit of time that you invest on the front end in a labor peace agreement will save you many times over that in the long run. So I'm, as one member of this tax committee, I'm a little bit disappointed that I supported over $400 million going to your community, and then you come back down here and tell me that this is a bad policy? But I did hear you say that was it a statewide policy that it might be better? So if we adopt Representative Liebling's amendment, does that make it better? Will we then support it?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think you were implying what I was not necessarily inferring, that it should necessarily be a statewide policy. What I was implying was the fact that Rochester was singled out amongst other outstate great, regional centers for treatment in this particular because of the city of the first class status. To your other point regarding the prevailing, in my previous life, I'm the retired superintendent of schools in Rochester, and for a number of years down there, we had prevailing wage agreements with construction, school construction purposes, and on expansion of the local male civic center. I know that that was done in the past, where the owners and the unions would sit down and we'd work out this arrangement, and it was a first-class arrangement, and it worked very, very well. But we made those choices to do that. And again, we initiated that activity down there. It worked extremely well, and we would hope to be able to continue that.
Representative Simonson.
And to that point, I just think that if you give this a chance to work, you'll find that it will work very well in your favor as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, I've heard this from more than one that came up today. Give me a specific example of why you think that a labor peace agreement is going to hurt you. And I'll preface that with, it seemed to work very well when the Republican National Convention came to town. They asked for a labor peace agreement as well, because it helps both sides. So tell me why this is going to hurt you.
Mr. Williams.
Madam Chair, I'd like to call on Gary Newman. He's the Assistant City Administrator. I think he can better answer that question.
Madam Chair, whoever can answer the question, that would be great.
Thank you, Representative Schoen. Mr. Newman, welcome again.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. I don't think we're saying that the concept of a labor peace agreement would be harmful. The devil is in the details in the language. We think there's many things in the language of this bill that are complicated and need work. We pointed out a few of them. We think there's more in the bill.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. Well, there was a lot of devils in the details last year, too. And, you know, the fact remains that this is to protect the state investment. And there's a heavy state investment that's going to Rochester. And anywhere else it goes, it should be protected as well. I'm still failing to understand, then, if there's the devils in the details, exactly what is the problem?
Mr. Newman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's state investment in bonding projects all over the state of Minnesota. And, you know, in our case, the bonding project that we're hoping to do, we're going to do a project labor agreement to construct it. I don't think that's required of bonding projects throughout Minnesota, and they're not requiring a labor peace agreement for those in the other areas of Minnesota. So at this point, we're fairly new to this bill. As I mentioned, we first heard about it a few days ago. But we do think that the language in the bill has some issues. And that's something we discussed with Representative Nelson yesterday, and we're going to continue to discuss. But we do have concerns about how the broad language in the bill is going to be applied in our case, in which there's going to be multiple projects, some of which, you know, we may have a situation, as Mr. Williams mentioned, where the definition of infrastructure in one of the lines could say that if we do a street project or utility project, all of a sudden a hotel is constructed that may use that street or the electric service, are they required to have a project labor agreement? And who determines that? I mean, at that point, that would be a matter, I think that would be very confusing for the community, for the owner of that property, and probably for the union as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And you said several times project labor agreement. Oh, so
project labor agreement is different than a labor peace agreement.
Yes. Correct. And I just want to, we need to make sure that we're clear about what we're talking
project
about. We're talking about a labor peace agreement,
right,
which keeps the project, the money that's from the state, keeps the project on task. No one can interfere from it on either side. It keeps the project moving. And that's a wise investment. So
right.
I appreciate you taking the time to answer my questions.
Thank you, Representative Schoen. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, first of all, the simple truth of the matter is there's not much difference between a project labor agreement and a labor peace agreement. It's just that a project labor agreement affects the construction.
Correct.
Of facilities and infrastructure and buildings. labor peace agreements are much more applicable to hospitality workers, people who clean your toilet, people who serve your dinner. I can't for the life of me understand why you would treat one group of workers in one manner and not afford workers in another sector of the economy in the same way. It has something to do with the market. It has something to do with wages. It has something to do with the fact that you can't build in your community without project labor agreements and without good union contractors. I would argue in the totality of the project, especially with the unbelievable commitment this legislature made to your community a year ago, that you can't find it in your hearts to allow a labor peace agreement so that hospitality workers can be afforded the same kind of comfort given to the building trades, that the hospitality worker is going to be able to organize freely in a democratic fashion without the unfair influence of management. Last year, many of us were supportive of the $500 million plus given to your community, which could have gone to Kenyon or Wanamingo or any other community. Or Duluth or Minneapolis or St. Cloud. But many of us were tending to support your DMZ with labor peace in mind. And along the way, we lost labor peace, and you got the money. Could you explain to me why you would treat construction and building trades in one way and hospitality workers who clean your toilets and serve your food in another way?
Mr. Nguyen.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know that we would. The thing is, we haven't had a choice, and we haven't had any discussion of this bill. Nobody's talked to us about this bill prior to the last couple of days. So it is, as I said, last session, the League of Cities was involved in this bill. We weren't directly, at least we were not, on the city end of things, directly involved in the bill. I'm not saying that we wouldn't. I mean, you know, the point that was raised earlier is Minneapolis and St. Paul did it as a matter of discussion and as a matter of choice. The topic has not been raised in Rochester. We've had a lot of more contact with the building trades union, and I think we actually are the test case for Minnesota for doing a project labor agreement, because I think we did, you know, we had to go to court over doing a project labor agreement at the Mayo Civic Center the last time that we had an expansion there. So we certainly have been cognizant of unions and the benefit they bring to our community and others.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Ansels.
I'll put a period on this. I want the record to show that I didn't get an answer. I want the record to show that all this ancillary discussion about the Mayo Civic Center and the first time only PLA and all of that has nothing to do with why you would want it to be the policy to treat one group of workers in one way and another group of workers in another way. Representative Nelson, thank you for bringing this bill forward again, as we did last year, and I hope it becomes law this year.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Then it's, I should just say, Benson, Davids, Drazkowski, Liebling, Earhart. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if Mr. Quillis could come, I just had a quick question for him. I came in as he was just starting to testify, and I think I heard him say that you could have, as part of this, privately owned businesses that would be impacted by this that had no connection whatsoever to getting in. I think I heard him say that you could have, as part of this, privately owned businesses that would be impacted by this that had no connection whatsoever to getting state funds. They didn't benefit from state funds. They just happened to be housed in some entity that did. So are you telling us then those employees of that group could be subject to union representation? Is that, did I hear you correctly?
Mr. Quillis, and then
Madam Chair, Nelson. Representative Anderson, yes. My interpretation of, and I apologize, I didn't bring it down. I think it's on the second page, 2.18, but it deals with definitions, subleases, subcontracts. So our interpretation of it is that if you have a facility such as a Jamba Juice or a coffee shop within that hotel in the city of a first class that received more than $2 million, you would then be subject.
And Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Quillis, so it could also theoretically be just a mom-and-pop shop. This could be a husband, wife, and their kids that are operating out of one of these facilities. They could also then be represented by a union. Is that your interpretation of how you read it?
That
Mr.
is our
Quillis.
Interpretation.
Okay, and Representative Nelson, you wanted to respond,
Chair,
too.
Madam Chair, and it does not force unionization. It just forces the two sides to be able to talk. The choice of whether the employees want to be formed to join the union is up to the employees. It just gives the union the ability to talk to them without being locked out by many of the bad practices that can happen. I'm not saying that they're happening down in Rochester or any place in the state, but bad practices that can happen on the management side. They agree that we're going to not do that. The union agrees that we're not going to do some of the bad practices that people may think that unions do, strikes, pickets, disruption of business. Both sides say we're not going to do these things. We're going to agree to talk. But it does not guarantee a union. It does not force unionization. It doesn't create a union. It just says both sides are going to be able to talk and sit down and have a civilized conversation. And if the employees that are working in this establishment, be it Jamba Juice, coffee shop, a little mom and pop shop that's in there, say, no, I don't want to be in the union. I heard your pitch. I'm not interested. It stops it there. It doesn't force them to join a union any way or form.
Representative Anderson.
But Representative Nelson, as your bill reads right now, the only representation that they could choose or that they are, the only representation that they can do is through a union, isn't that correct?
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, no. They can choose the union that's interested in organizing these people, this group of people, can ask for the labor peace agreement, or if there's a labor peace agreement on the project, they then can talk to these people, but if the employees do not want to be in the union, they're not forced to be in the union. They can say no. It would follow the normal organizing process minus some of the bad parts that happen in those processes. They would be able to have a civilized conversation, and it will bring it to a vote. And if the employees vote no, we don't want a union, they don't have a union.
But Representative Anderson. Representative Nelson, you kind of missed my point, though. As you stated, the only ones that could be part of the negotiations of the labor project agreement is a union representative, correct?
Madam Chair, yes. Representative, it would be the if a union wants to have a labor peace agreement and puts that forth, it would be between the union and the developer. And going forward, it would be if it's on a project. There's a labor peace agreement. The management says we're not going to interfere. We're going to take a neutral side. We'll let you talk, and that would lead to whether they say whether they want to or don't want, whether they vote on having union or not, don't vote on having union. It would let the process go forward without some of the nasty things that happen on both sides.
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, assuming that if they don't choose to join the union, though, what are the fair share union dues that they will be required to pay?
Representative Nelson.
There are no fair share dues. It's not. These are not public unions. The private unions do not have fair share dues.
Representative Anderson.
And Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, what would be their dues, though, if they were a member?
Representative Nelson.
If they were a member, it depends on what union. I don't know what union they'd be joining. It could be the HER 17, if they're the ones that push it. It could be the steel workers that go on, that choose to, that ask for the labor peace agreement. And those are set by the members in the Democratic vote within their internal, their local unions. And so there's no way to answer that question.
Anderson?
Madam Chair, this will be the last bit. What I'm concerned with, Representative Nelson, is that this is, you know, another walk down the aisle of we're going to be unionizing private business owners, much like you did with the daycare providers, all the child care providers here in the state of Minnesota. And so I'm just concerned that we are going down that avenue again, once again, to funnel money to unions at the detriment to employees that just want to keep more money in their pocket. So that's just my concern, Madam Chair, and that's the only questions I had. But thank you.
Thank you. Representative Benson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And just, if I could, I just think there's some historical context that's missing in our discussion today, and I'm just wondering if Mr. Lunenberg would be willing to come back to the table and just a brief little discussion here of how we've gotten in the United States to this situation. Now, Mr. Lunenberg and Representative Nelson, we know that in the 1930s, about 1935 or 36, the Wagner Act was passed, which established the National Labor Relations Board. And there were a whole series of changes in the way that labor management negotiations and relationships should take place after that. And basically, it gave working people, industrial unions and others, an opportunity to collectively organize and to bargain for wages and working conditions. And that went on for a while until about 1948, I think it was, or 49, when we had the Taft-Hartley Act, which had a major impact. But since that time, we know you, for example, mentioned the Tennessee VW plant, where actually VW was encouraging the formation of a union there, because that is common in Germany, and labor relations with management in Germany has worked very well, at least since the end of the Second World War. But we had a U.S. senator and others who vociferously intervened in that process and convinced the workers, at least at this time. And I noticed the National Labor Relations Board is evaluating whether or not there were fair labor practices in that whole arrangement. And we also know from history that at least since the election of President Ronald Reagan, there's been a great difficulty in providing membership when there were openings in the Labor Relations Board, National Labor Relations Board, is operated. My question for you, Mr. Lunenberg and Representative Nelson, if very quickly, if you could explain to the committee here and to the audience what happened to the notion that the Wagner Act established in the mid-30s that working people would be allowed to organize collectively without interference because it was considered a democratic process, just as we allow entrepreneurs to form corporations without harassment from the government. What has happened that makes it impossible or makes it important that we have these negotiations that you're proposing simply to allow people who should, under the Wagner Act, have the democratic right to organize without harassment from their employers? What has there been a change in law, or is this simply, are we seeing here a slow deterioration of the original labor laws that we had established in the 1930s? Why are we at this situation where we need to have these peace agreements?
Well, Madam Chair, I would say that the Representative Benson went down a lane of history, and all we have to do is go back. We want to go in history, the Teamster strike that happened in North Minneapolis. That's just not too far away from where Target Field is, where people were shot and killed and beaten because they wanted to talk to the union and discuss the ability to form and have a union and have and enforce their rights that they had under the Wagner Act. This is what the labor peace agreement is trying to prevent. Is these, like I said, bad things that happen on both sides, on the labor side, the things that they can do illegally that they can do to disrupt business, on the management side, the things that they can do that some are legal and some are not under current law with the National Labor Relations Act, and to prevent those bad things from happening, to let them, these people say, okay, management says we promise we won't do these things, labor says we promise we're not going to do our nasty things, let's just sit down and talk. And that's what this is about. As Representative Davids always likes to talk, this is about trying to get peace in the valley and let the people talk and discuss it and have a conversation without having to go resort to all sorts of tactics that in the public make people not hate both sides of the negotiating part of that. So this just lets people sit down and talk and can have a continuing conversation about this without having some of these nasty things that have gone on in the past. And that's what this bill is about, is allowing people to talk and have a civilized conversation.
Mr. Lunenberg, did you also want to respond to Representative Benson?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Benson, I appreciate greatly your grasp of some of our labor history. We unions in general in this country operate at, I would say, in a constrained position. We are regulated by the Department of Labor. We are parties to the National Labor Relations Board and National Labor Relations Act. We also have folks under the Railway Labor Act here at Local 17 in the Twin Cities that are considered a necessity and so are actually denied the right to actually boycott and picket and strike. So it's fair to say that labor unions in general are following the rules that are set down by the federal government. And organizations like Unite Here, we use these policies and promote these policies because we are also taxpayers and members in the community. And we just believe that these are good policies that protect the state's proprietary interests and in some cases here in Minnesota have protected various other governmental units in Minneapolis and St. Paul. We also believe that these policies work here in Minnesota. Governor Pawlenty signed legislation that called for labor peace at the Mall of America site, which led to a simple negotiation between Unite Here and the parties interested at the Radisson Blue site in Bloomington on the South Pad. We recently just finished negotiating a labor peace agreement for JW Marriott on the North Pad of the mall. It's fair to say businesses is doing well out there for the new hotelier and the hotelier that plans on coming in and for the perhaps two other hotels are going to be added at the same site. And it's because we did create a orderly path that says the union and the operators can come to an agreement on talking with workers.
Okay. Representative Benson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And we don't want to delabor belabor this too much, except, Representative Nelson, you talked about the Teamsters strike. We know that there were a number of people who were killed in that. We know from history that management hired what later became known as goons to fight the labor organizers. And then later on, a number of labor organizations picked up on that same practice and hired their own goons. And some of those goons came from organized crime. My point of mentioning all that is your desire to try to maintain labor peace is very, very important component in maintaining social peace in this country, so that we do not have labor nor management going to extremes in their conflicts over something that could be resolved if they were willing to sit down and negotiate. Madam Chair, if I may be indulged to ask Mr. Williams and Mr. Newman just a quick question or two, and I'll be finished.
Please. And then members, as they're coming back, we have Representative Davids, Draskowski, Liebling, Earhart, Garofalo. We still have amendments, and we are voting today. And just letting folks know. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Williams, I guess my concern, since I voted for the state bonding for the development of what I think is going to be a tremendous project for the state of Minnesota, not just for Rochester, although I have a lot of relatives who live in Rochester and pay taxes, by the way, and will be paying some of those taxes that we insisted that Rochester contribute, which I thought was only fair that they do so. But because we're making all these investments, and similar to Representative Answell here, I assumed that that the Rochester Chamber would not be opposing legislation which would lead to these management labor agreements, so that we can see to it that the investments the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota are making will not be disrupted. It'll be finished on time. Could you encourage me to believe that the Chamber of Commerce in Rochester will encourage developers to enter into labor agreements or not? Are you going to take any position on this to encourage and folks like myself who voted for all these funds?
Mr. Williams.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, the Chamber of Commerce believes very strongly in a partnership between management and labor, that we believe that by working together, we're going to achieve the significant, lofty, but also, I believe, realistic goals of DMC and what we would like to see in our community moving forward, in our region, and also the benefit of the state of Minnesota. Having just really looked at this bill this morning, and after hearing some of the comments and concerns out there, do I believe that some type of agreement going forward and working together, encourage working together, is in the best interest of everybody? Yes, I do. I have real concerns about some of the details in this bill that I think there needs to be a lot of work, in my opinion. I've not sat down and gone through it line by line, but I've sensed just from some of the conversation today and my brief looking at it, that some of that work still needs to be done extensively. Would the chamber agree to something, or get on board something like this, the labor peace agreement, when we have very strongly supported in the past project agreements, conversations? I think it depends upon the devil's in the details. It depends upon how it is written. We are not averse to having some strength of understanding of working together. We believe that very strongly. We've got great workers in Rochester. I mentioned in my testimony that the chamber has had great support from the unions down there mm-hmm. for various initiatives, and DMC had great support from the unions. We all want the same thing in moving forward, which led to my last comment. We problem solve very well in Rochester, and we will get this taken care of.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence. And just one last question, Mr. Williams, and you know, I want to put you personally necessarily on the spot, but do you feel that if a company who directly or indirectly was benefiting from this state investment in the medical center in Rochester, who would oppose the opportunity of their workers to democratically discuss whether or not they wanted to join a union? Do you feel that such an action by a company would be a violation, if not the letter, at least the spirit of the Wagner Act?
Mr. Williams.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I do not know the details of the Wagner Act.
Well, for example, allowing
employees to.
Yeah. Madam Chair. Well, just I guess the central point is the Wagner Act guarantees the rights of workers to consider joining a union in a democratic process.
Mr. Williams.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, in my previous work life, which I referenced, I was a member at one time, not only of the Papermakers Union when I worked in the Minnesota Ontario paper mill up in International Falls many, many years ago. A lifetime card-carrying member for $5 it cost me, which back in 1962 was a lot of money, but I still got the card. And my involvement as a member of then an association, now a union, Education Minnesota, yeah, which was then Minnesota Education Association, they did some really good things for schools and school districts, and I really applaud them. And I don't look at it as unions are negative or unions are bad. Mm-hmm. I certainly don't, because I've been a member of one, and I've seen the really good things that they've done. I just think that this needs a lot of work, yes, sir, okay, going forward.
Madam Chair, and the final thing here.
Fourth final.
You know, the fourth final. Well, I don't participate in debate too much, and I'm going to be leaving, so you just have to indulge me a little bit here. Sorry about that. We don't have to be back till when? Much later in the afternoon. You know, according to the deed agreement, average pay for hospitality workers in Rochester is about $8 an hour, and you know there's a debate and discussion here in the legislature about raising the minimum wage, which I support. I support it only because I have always believed the best social welfare program is a well-paying job. And not only that, but I'm responsible for the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota and the investments they need to make in food assistance, housing assistance, health care assistance, all these other kinds of things, which I've always seen as a subsidy for business, actually, for companies who are not doing the responsible thing and paying their workers a living wage. So that's why I'm asking these questions as to whether or not the Chamber of Commerce will step up and do help us all a little bit to see that we no longer have to make these large contributions in social welfare spending, which is coming out of the pockets of Minnesota taxpayers. Because companies that do pay a decent wage are disadvantaged in the marketplace. And I would like to see a more balanced approach. And I'd certainly like to see reductions in the amount of state funding we have to spend on the social safety net, as it's called, which is being caused to a great degree by people, for example, $8 an hour. That's $324 a week. That really puts a tremendous strain on us here in the legislature to try to have something done about that, so we do not have people living in perpetual poverty. I want to see that people have an opportunity not only to be employed but gainfully employed, so they choose that route rather than looking to the government for subsidies. So that's why I asked the question, Mr. Williams. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Benson. Representative Davids.
Thank you very much. And Representative Nelson, I actually read the bill. I usually don't read bills. But this one, you said five times, sit down and have a civilized conversation. Where in the bill does it say it's going to be civilized?
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, Representative David, I don't think it's civil. It says in there civilized. I guess that's my interpretation of it, as opposed to some of the nasty, incriminating things that can happen in the bargaining table.
Representative David.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If Mr. Newman, I just have a very short question for Mr.
Newman.
It'll be my first final question. I have two more. Mr. Newman, just very simply, yes or no, does Rochester, the City of Rochester, support this bill?
Mr. Newman.
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, the city sees that there would need to be significant changes in the bill to simplify the process and clarify some of the things before we would support the bill.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the answer is no on that. And so for my final question here regarding the Rochester Unionization Mandate Bill, I would like to ask for a roll call.
Okay, so a roll call has been requested when we get to that point. Okay. And members, I appreciate that this committee was supposed to be over at 2 o'clock and lots of people have to get to other places, but we still have a lot of members asked to have questions, and then we have amendments. Oh, we're going to keep going. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Wondering if Mr. Williams could answer a question for me.
Mr. Williams.
While he's taking his seat, just maybe a comment for the author. Representative Nelson, I noticed when you first introduced the bill, you talked about the objective of the bill being to protect the proprietary interests of the state, and then I later heard you say something about making it so that there was peace in the valley or in the workplace or something like that. So those seem to be two really conflicting and different objectives, just an observation. But Mr. Williams, back to that first stated objective by the author that this bill is intended to protect the proprietary interests of the state. I'm curious what this will do to protect the proprietary interests of the businesses. Can you tell us, does this bill in any way help or protect the proprietary interests of the businesses?
Mr. Williams.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Drazkowski, not in its current form do I believe that it protects the interests of business. We were concerned as a chamber that this is not addressing what I would also consider proprietary interests that might exist in St. Cloud or Mankato or Moorhead or Worthington or wherever. Whomever may receive some state dollars. You know, I think it's admirable to protect the state interests, but from a public policy standpoint, let's be pretty uniform about this going forward. So the way this bill is currently set up, no, I do not believe that it protects the interests of business.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Williams. That's what I kind of pondered after listening to discussion and reading the bill as well. And what is certainly a final comment, and I won't have three finals, Madam Chair, but and that is an observation is that it does appear to protect or develop a proprietary interest for the union. And members, an observation, it seems that we're peering in here to an arena where crony capitalism has been developed by this legislature. And we saw last year when this particular piece of $585 million of funding for one particular interest in the state, and we saw it with a Viking stadium, and we've seen it with trains, and we've got more proposals on the table for more of them. But government and business came together, and now we're seeing the culmination to include the all-important triad of big government, big business, and big union coming in and asking for their share of the largesse that we extracted from the public and laid out in the form of crony capitalism. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be voting no against the forced card check on Rochester businesses bill.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. I first of all, I just want to correct a couple of misstatements or misimpressions that were left. I mean, this really shouldn't be about DMC, but maybe Mr. Michael can help me in case I don't remember correctly, but I think on the spreadsheet the amount for DMC last year was zero. It might have been not quite zero. Is that, Mr. Michael, is that what you recall? I might be wrong about that. But, I mean, certainly there was no $585 million on the bottom line anywhere. So if people think that that was there, Mr. Michael, am I wrong on that?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I don't remember the exact amount, but I'm guessing that it first would start in the tails and then stretch out in installments over years.
Right.
And Representative Liebling, I do
you,
remember.
Madam Chair.
It does start at zero, but it caps it up to $30 million a year till the total public subsidy is $585. as the testifier mentioned, there's a piece for the local community, and then there's a piece from the local community and from the county. And I know Representative Liebling's making a point here, and she knows this very well. But, you know, on net, though, the total DMC, when it builds out over time, is 585 of public subsidy in one form or another, with the overwhelming majority mm-hmm. coming from the state. But there's a trigger that says first the project has to do X amount of investment before they start getting the public subsidy. So we'll see that play out in the tails over time. But, you know, I hear what you're saying. You're trying to not conflate these issues, but members are doing that. And I think we can feel a little bit of the tension in the room as it, you know, particularly, and I should say Representative Liebling, you know, we do need to recognize that the area and you were very level-headed in trying to think through the best strategy for your constituents and your community. But there's probably not another community that has received that much state aid per capita mm-hmm. anywhere in the state mm-hmm. ever. So I think for folks who are here from Rochester, you should mm-hmm. understand why some members may be reacting, because this is not that kind of investment that was put into that community. There's nothing like it.
Well,
and just, you know, hearing that there was state money put in there in this bill, I think people are getting far afield listening to people. It only applies to projects with $2 million of state money. So it's not to every hotel ever. So just to be clear. So
right, but Madam Chair, I mean, my point, and just to correct people, is that this is over a long period of time. So not to say that Rochester didn't get something, because certainly it did. But, you know, I just don't want people to think, oh, you got a big block of money. I just want to correct that, because it really is a big misimpression about what this means and over what period of time. And $30 million in any given year is, you know, certainly less than the Twin Cities would get in bonding, certainly, in a year. So, you know, I mean, it's not... I just want to put that in perspective. But that wasn't why I wanted to really speak about this bill. You know, we've heard... a lot of the argument here seems to be between one side and the other about whether labor peace agreements are a good thing. I think they are a good thing. And I think that Representative Anzels was kind of unfair to Mr. Newman about this, because he's not against labor peace agreements. You know, this is not for him. He's trying to represent the city of Rochester. And I think that the issue here, for me at least, and I think for Mr. Newman and for the city, is that what's in this bill isn't workable as it's written. Now, personally, I would be very happy to have this policy, to have a policy that there should be labor peace agreements throughout the state on any project where there is state money. I think that is not a bad policy. I think it's worked well. We've heard it's worked well. I'd love to have the city of Rochester adopt that as an ordinance, the way Minneapolis and St. Paul and Duluth have done. I really support that policy. But that said, I don't think that this is good legislation. I think it's not ready for prime time. It has a lot of ambiguities in it. It's as it's written, it is not workable. But, you know, so I guess maybe it's a bit, I'm sort of giving a mixed message here with my amendment, because I want to make this statewide. If for those of you who think this is a great policy, and I am one of them, let's make it a statewide policy. So I don't see a reason not to do that. So, Madam Chair, I would move the A1 amendment. I'm sorry, the A2 amendment, which just simply removes the limitation to the cities of the first class. And so this would just make it a statewide policy for the state of Minnesota. So for all of you who think that the bill is, you know, this is a good policy, which, you know, Representative Anzels, I do think it should, that people who work in these kinds of jobs should, you know, be available, be able to form a union without interference from management, I think would be a very good policy for Rochester. We've had some of these issues. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I think a lot of the community is concerned that if these five-star hotels get built and whatever, that we want to make sure that the economic vitality is spread around to the people who work in those hotels. We don't want it to be low-wage jobs, and then the city and the state have to do extra infrastructure to support people who can't get a living wage. That's not what we want for our state. So this is a good policy. It's a policy that we should all want in our communities, and that's why I'm urging everyone to vote for this amendment.
Yeah, on the amendment, first, Representative Nelson. We're going to ask Mr. Lunenburg to comment on the amendment, and then Representative Dabney's on the list on the amendment, right? And then after that, we're going to go back to Representative Garofalo, who will be next on the list, and then Anzels, and then Runbeck. So on the amendment, Representative Nelson.
Chairman Chesky, while I agree that it might be a good policy statewide, at the current time with this bill, I do not support the amendment.
Okay, so Representative Nelson, that's your position on the A2. Mr. Lunenberg, could Mr. Lunenberg join us on the A2? Just want to get your thoughts on the A2 amendment.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, and again, I appreciate the conversations that we've had about this. For our labor organization, I can tell you that... to create a layer of bureaucracy in an area where there will not be a labor dispute, we just believe is not necessary. That's our simple position.
Representative Dabney on the A2.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and probably a little broader than that. But
you're getting ahead of people.
Well, you know, it's a strategy, Madam Chair. Okay. I would also want to oppose the A2 amendment. Representative Liebling, in your comments, you said, well, you know, if a hotel is being built wherever, they should be covered by this. Well, the fact of the matter is hotels aren't built wherever. They're built where there's a business reason to do that. And Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, Rochester, there's a lot of reasons to do that. Representative Anzels makes a good point, not in Balsam Township. So they're built, they aren't built wherever, and so specifying where this bill applies and in treating those communities consistently across the state is a sensible response. A number of the Rochester representatives have said Rochester shouldn't be singled out. Well, they didn't object last year when Rochester was singled out for $568 million in public funds. They like that. I'm concerned that the average pay in the hospitality industry in Rochester, according to the Southeast Labor Council, is $8 an hour. It's not as good as Ways and Means the other day, but it's close. $8 an hour is not a wage that shares the taxpayers' largesse of $568 million in investments. And the risk we run in Rochester is the imbalance between the public investment and the public gain when the average wage is $8 an hour. Members, our responsibility is not to side with labor, and it's not to side with business. Our responsibility is to protect the taxpayers' investment. And project labor agreements protect the taxpayers' investment. When we're looking at investing $568 million over a number of years, we should make sure that that is invested wisely, efficiently, and accurately. And this allows for that to go forward. I would ask for a no vote on the A2 and a yes vote on the bill. The bill has been out there since April of last year. Rochester coming forward and saying, we just learned about this, doesn't meet the common sense test when a bill has a bill number of 1765 and was introduced on April 11th of last year. Thank you.
On the A2, further discussion on the A2.
Yeah.
Because I have Garofalo, Anzels, and Runbeck, and they were all before
that.
Representative Liebling.
All right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think, am I getting the last word here before we vote on it? I don't know if are there others that wanted to speak to the amendment. So
I actually want to speak to it.
Okay.
If I may. And not really strongly on, you know, how I feel just about this, but I am gonna vote against the A2. But you know, I feel very torn about this, Representative Liebling, and I, you know, my community has had these issues, and I will tell you my reason is a little different, and that is because I do support labor peace, but I know what happened last year, And as has been stated, you know, this bill has been out there, and it was part of the discussions in the Tax Conference Committee and as it relates to DMC. Oh, yes, it was. So if folks in Rochester are surprised, this was in the negotiations, in the Conference Committee, as it relates to DMC. And I want to put on the record for folks who may not recall, the House conferees took a strong position for labor peace, and we lost that vote. And the Senate voted it down. I believe it was one of our only roll call votes. And I will tell you that the reason I think a smaller approach, listening to all of this, is better for the folks who at the end of the day do support labor peace is because I don't think a statewide proposal will get through the Senate. We couldn't get it through a few counties last time. And so that's good news for folks who don't want labor peace, but for those of us who supported it, I think, you know, something smaller here is better. So, you know, I know Representative Liebling, and I know she cares profoundly about these people, so her values are ones that are strong with labor. And I hope folks who hear her amendment, even if they vote against that, know that about Representative Liebling. And you know, Representative Anzels, you know, part of the reason I'm such a strong supporter of labor peace is I have a very strong hospitality community. And it has been a personal frustration of mine to watch the legislature react to issues that are labor and hear parts of labor. And Representative Anzels said it well. There's a whole bunch of people who are not in some of the bigger groups that people think are organized labor. And they are the maids who clean the toilets, who change people's sheets after they stay in the hotels in my community and in all kinds of communities. These are mostly women. They are poor. And they are mostly not represented. And they are not who people see as labor. They often don't speak English. These are people who are living in poverty. And so when we talk about who is labor, it's not generally a face people think about, but the labor peace agreements address these hospitality workers who are a sort of a different face than people often think of who labor is when we talk about these issues at the Capitol. So I support labor peace. I will tell Representative Nelson, you and your advocates, that, you know, I don't know that things will change much in the Senate this year. So I like that it's smaller, but I hear what Representative Liebling's saying. If it's a good policy, it ought to be a good policy. So it's with regret that I'm going to vote against the amendment, but I just, you know, I have very mixed feelings about a lot of pieces, and I understand you're doing a great job defending your community and kind of how you're weighing this in and out, but I do want to give you the last word on it. But I think it's a big deal on both sides of the aisle here as people are sort of torn on these issues. So Representative Liebling.
Right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for that. And I just, you know, I do want to say that just to respond a little bit to Representative Dabney, you know, this isn't only about hotels, right? By the terms of the bill, it's food and beverage operation integral to a hotel, major league or minor league sports facility, convention center, civic center, cultural venue with catering or cafeteria. You know, we're doing a big bonding bill this year, and we're going to have a lot of projects the state is going to help finance all over the state. And there is really no reason, if you really, you know, I appreciate what the chair is saying about she wants it to pass and she thinks it would be difficult, you know, to have it be more broad. And that's the only legitimate argument I've heard, frankly, with all due respect, Representative Dabney, because yours doesn't hold water. Why should a civic center in Mankato or a civic center in St. Cloud that's built with public money not be subject to the same thing? It just doesn't make any sense to me. Anywhere in the state is spending money, the workers should have the same opportunity. And, you know, if there's no union there, then there's no bureaucracy. I don't think it's... Under the terms of this bill, as unclear as they are, a union has to show up and ask for the labor peace agreement. No union shows up, there's no bureaucracy, there's no big deal. So extending this to the whole state doesn't hurt anybody if there's no union there. It basically has no effect. So I don't know why anybody, other than the reason the chair has just given, if you think that, you know, that... you know, it won't give it as good a chance, maybe. That would be the honest reason. But if you're really for this policy and you really want to see it apply and you really want to see workers all over the state, you know, I don't know why you'd vote against this, because it ought to apply. It ought to protect workers in every corner of Minnesota, because you're absolutely right, Madam Chair. You know, we've got people that are doing the tough work, And the bottom line is that when you can't earn a living doing a tough job like that, then the state has to step in and support you. And that's, you know, we should make sure that work pays in the state, and I fully support the idea that organizing is one way to do that. So I don't know why members who say that they're really for this policy would vote against this amendment. So with that, Madam Chair, I would ask for a yes vote on the amendment.
Okay. All right. We're going to vote on the A2 amendment. I'm looking at the issue. No. Okay. If not,
Madam
members,
Chair.
We're going to vote on the A2. Oh.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I don't know that anyone's called for a roll call, but I'd like to call for a roll call.
Sure. Representative Barrett requests a roll call on the A2 amendment. Okay. On the amendment.
Lynchesky?
No.
Loeffler?
No.
Davids? Anderson?
No.
Anzels?
No.
Barrett?
No.
Benson?
No.
Carlson?
No.
Dabney?
No.
Draskowski?
No.
Earhart?
No.
Groffalo? Hansen?
No.
Lesch?
No.
Liebling?
Yes.
Lilly?
No.
Loon?
No.
Mack?
No.
Marquardt?
No.
Moline?
No.
Myra?
No.
Paymar?
Yes.
Pepin?
No.
Runbeck?
No.
Schoen?
No.
Simonson?
Yes.
Slocum?
No.
Groffalo?
No.
Yes.
No.
Oh.
I thought we were on final passage.
It's not going to make any difference.
I didn't think so.
Thank you. There being 3 ayes, 23 nays, the amendment is not adopted. Thank you, though, Representative Liebling. Appreciate your amendment. Thank you so much. And we're going to go back to the list, and Representative Garofalo is up first.
Pass.
He will pass. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've actually noticed another citizen from Rochester in the gallery, and I'm wondering if Mr. S. would have a comment about the bill.
The citizen from Rochester have a comment. Yes.
Citizen from Rochester.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and representatives, members of the committee. My name is Russell Hess. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Southeast Minnesota Area Labor Council. I wear many hats. That's the one I'm speaking under today. Our labor council represents 40,000 AFL-CIO members over the 16 counties of extreme southeast and south central Minnesota. We fully support the idea, the legislation that's before the committee today for the labor peace agreement in Rochester. And I just wanted to put a few points on some of the other comments that were made. I've been a part of the decision making and the collaborative working together of the citizens of Rochester before on different issues. And I fully agree that works great when it works great. I think a few of the comments here give light to the fact that I don't know that anyone has cared about the plight of the working poor in Rochester in the past, because if that were the case, we've had many, many years in Rochester to talk about why the average pay for hospitality workers in Rochester today, according to deed numbers from the third quarter of 2013, is about $8 an hour, $324 a week. We look forward to engaging Rochester and the DMC and other representatives in that discussion and how we can make sure that everyone benefits from the DMC funding in Rochester, including hospitality workers and people in every other industry that are going to see more jobs and more opportunity because of it. I don't know how that happens in the hospitality industry without the opportunity for workers to have a voice on the job and a union to represent them in a fair and dignified process. Union hotel workers in Rochester, and there are some, and those hotels compete side by side with non-union hotels. House room cleaners in union hotels start at $9.91 an hour, and healthcare benefits and some sort of pension plan in Rochester. After 5 years, they make $13.82 an hour. At that point, we can have a discussion about how these become living wage jobs and how we lift the working poor out of poverty in Rochester. I don't know how that happens in the absence of that being part of the discussion in Rochester. I know from experience the power that this union has on the lives of workers. I used to work for Local 21 in Rochester. I've sat in the bowels of the Kaler Hotel in the crowded little lunchrooms. I've talked to the workers there from Cambodia, Vietnam, Laos, Serbia, Bosnia, Ethiopia, Somalia, about the difference that union makes in their lives, and it means health insurance. I'd like to know how many other hospitality workers in Rochester have health insurance. The ones that work at the Motel 6, I bet don't. Those people, or those workers, are for all of us to support. Labor peace is going to go a long way to furthering the cause of working people in Rochester. We fully support it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We have Representative Runbeck and Barrett, and that's it. And then we can vote. Representative Runbeck.
Just really don't want to belabor this anymore, but I had a comment on a question, I guess, about the conversation, because it seems that we haven't addressed that you are negotiating a terms of the labor peace agreement and have stated that, you know, in the event that there's something arbitrary and capricious that the union would demand, that there would be an arbitrator brought in. And so I guess, first of all, that sort of suggests to me that, as you think about it, we don't have a real contract negotiations going on where two sides have a lot to lose. That's what a negotiation is, isn't it, Representative Nelson? Both sides have something to lose, so they're going to bargain in good faith. This would appear to be a situation where the employer has everything to lose. The bargaining unit, which isn't representing anybody, has really nothing to lose. And so you do bring in the issue of capricious and arbitrary conditions that may be suggested. And what any example of what might be considered capricious and arbitrary?
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair and Representative Runbeck, that's a part of the bill that's actually there to protect the employer and to protect the state investment there in that project. If, for example, the union wanted to tank a project and they came in with demands that are unreasonable, the terms you use that are in the bill, arbitrary and capricious, if they brought exorbitant demands that they knew would never get agreed to by as part of the labor peace agreement, this isn't the negotiation of a possible future contract after they go through the whole negotiating process, but the negotiation between the union and the employer who's being asked to sign this labor peace agreement. If the union sets such high demands that they know aren't going to be met, the arbitrator can say no, that's arbitrary and capricious, and there is no longer a labor peace agreement, and you can go ahead with your project, and the union doesn't have the right to talk to these workers. So the union does have something to lose there. So this is a piece, again, that protects the employer, and it protects the state of Minnesota with our investment.
Representative Runbeck.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Nelson. I guess, you know, it seems to me the arbitration piece, I mean, it's somewhat pretending that there's going to be a fair result, because how many times is that arbitrator who is selected by the union going to say, gee, this sounds harsh? I mean, what comfort is it to the employer, I guess, when you understand that the arbitrator is probably going to always side with the union?
Madam Chair.
Nelson.
And the way the arbitration normally works is that there's a list of names put up. I think it's usually seven. There's an odd number of names. And each side throws out one of the names till they get to a agreed-upon arbitrator. And so that arbitrator is not union or non-union or pro-union or pro-business. It's people that are on the list from the Bureau of Mediation Services, the way they do it. And they said it's not always in favor of the union. In fact, in many cases, it's not in favor of the union if you've ever had to go through mediation services. It's, you know, those don't always come down in the favor of the worker or the union in all cases.
Representative Ronan.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Barrett.
Madam Chair, if you remember, I had a pretty substantial conversation on this subject a minute ago, so I'll pass.
Okay. If not, we are going to vote, and a roll call has been requested. So we're going to call for the vote. The motion is to that House Bill 1765, as adopted as amended, be referred to the General Register. Here we go.
Lincheski.
Aye.
Loeffler.
Yes.
Davids.
No.
Anderson.
No.
Ansels.
Yes.
Barrett.
No.
Benson.
Yes.
Carlson.
Yes.
Dabney.
Aye.
Drazkowski.
No.
Earhart.
Yes.
Garofalo. Hansen.
Yes.
Lesh.
Aye.
Liebling.
No.
Lilly.
Yes.
Loon.
No.
Mack.
No.
Marquardt.
Yes.
Moline.
Aye.
Myra.
No.
Paymar.
Aye.
Pepin.
No.
Runbeck.
No.
Schoen.
Yes.
Simonson.
Aye.
Slocum.
Yes.
Sellers.
Garofalo. Madam Chair, Garofalo.
Garofalo.
Garofalo?
No.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Mike. I'm assuming my vote didn't matter.
Even if it did, I would have wanted you to vote.
No, you wouldn't.
There being 16 ayes and 11 nays, the motion is passed and it has been sent to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Nelson and members. We are adjourned.
Thank you, Madam.